How is everyone tonight? Hey, shout out to you for being here. Super Bowl Sunday. You know, here we are. Here we are. We got four guys in the house. More girls, but four guys. So, shout out to us. But hey, I think tonight is going to be a really good night. Many of you know what we're talking about already. And so, I just think this is an important topic. An important conversation to have. Hopefully this is encouraging. Hopefully it answers questions if people have questions or gives you sort of information that you can take into your schools and share with other people. So that's the goal. So we're starting sort of a new part of this series called Is God Real? And I wanted to start with a quote. Tell me if this sounds familiar, like something you have heard or has been told to you before. Oh, this is the bad clicker. Okay. You cannot be an intelligent scientific thinker and still hold religious beliefs. It is one or the other. How many people have heard something like this before from a friend? Okay, a number of you, right? Richard Dawkins, if you don't know who he is one of the leading, sort of the face of atheism, I would say. One of the leading people sort of espousing this type of thought. Here's a couple other quotes I came across this week. I find it ludicrous that any thinking adult can believe in God, given that there has never been even one tiny bit of proof for his existence. Another quote, atheism is merely a sensible assessment of the nature of things based on a purely rational evaluation of the world. The only way to be a Christian is to close your eyes to all reason and evidence. These are common thoughts in our world. Many of you have probably come across them, and it begs the question, are they right? Are these people, when they say these type of things, are they correct and are we wrong? We have to ask. And it's a big question. I would say it's a scary question, honestly, because here we are all sitting in a church, right? If they're right, then Paul says, like, if we're wrong, then I am the greatest fool of all fools, right? If we're wrong, so it's a scary question, but what if they're right? Now, unfortunately, many Christians never ask this question. They never think about these things. I think Christians, when they come up against challenges like the one Dawkins presents or these other quotes, they sort of stuff it or even sort of pray that they just go away. Pray that these questions and these thoughts and these doubts and these challenges never come across their doorstep. But I want to tell you something that you probably already know. That doesn't help. Praying that these questions go away, stuffing them down and ignoring them does not help. It doesn't help you. It won't help your faith. I think a lot of the reason why people go to college and a number of folks lose their faith is because they've never thought about questions like this. And so when they're presented with a challenge, they have nothing to answer, not because no answer exists, but simply because they haven't thought about it. And now they're in a surrounding where they're in the minority, and so it becomes quickly becomes easy to disbelieve. And also it doesn't help the church. Like, as Christians, we need to sort of be able to present ourselves as people that are rational thinkers. We should think more, not less. We should think more and not less. And so it brings us back to the original question. Another way of asking it is, can you be an intelligent, scientifically minded thinker and still believe in God? This is really the question I want to ask tonight. Can you be an intelligent, scientifically minded thinker and still believe in God? Is there proof for God's existence? Is there actual or physical proof for God's existence, to believe in God? So over the next 3 weeks, this is the goal, to answer this question, to present a case for why belief in the Christian God is intelligently defensible as well as compelling. Also, why belief in the Christian God is actually the most reasonable, logical thing that we can think. Believe, right? The series, as I said, is called Is God Real? Now, when it comes to the question, is there physical, actual proof for God? I have bad news for you. There is not physical, actual proof, scientifically, that God exists. Okay? There's no fossil that we can hold up and point to and say, look, God was here. There's no snapshot that we have of God, etc. Scientifically, there's not proof, definitive, beyond a reasonable doubt, proof that God exists. But here's the thing that never gets brought up. The same goes for the other side of this conversation. There's also no scientific proof that God doesn't exist. And I think the thing that gets messed up a lot is that the world says the burden of proof is on us as Christians. You need to prove to me that God exists. Otherwise, God does not exist. But logically, that just doesn't add up. Logically, both sides should have to come to it neutrally and either prove that God does not exist or prove that God does exist. And as Tim Keller says, whether you're trying to prove or disprove the supernatural, neither can be proven empirically beyond all rational doubt. To put it another way, whether you want to believe in God or disbelieve in God, both of those viewpoints require faith. Both of those viewpoints require faith. Christians are told they're the ones that have faith, but atheists have just as much faith as we do, right? To put it another way, why do both entail faith, right? Let me show you a simple, silly illustration. Okay, imagine we have the natural world and the supernatural world. Now, this is a massive oversimplification. It's not super accurate, but for our purposes tonight, it will be helpful. Okay? When we talk about science, science only helps us in one of these two areas, the natural world. Science can only teach us about the natural world. It can only explain to us the natural world. Scientists can tell us nothing about the supernatural world. It cannot tell us that the supernatural world exists, and it also cannot tell us that the supernatural world does not exist. If anyone tries to tell you that science has disproven God, that it's a complete misunderstanding of what science is. Science is the study of the natural world. God, by definition, is outside of the natural world. He is in the supernatural realm. It can't speak to the supernatural at all, right? Which is why science could never prove or disprove God. But here's where we get into our conversation tonight. Science, our experience, our brains, what they can't offer us in proof, they can offer us in clues. They can give us signposts and clues, right? And so the question, the better question that we're going to ask tonight and in future weeks is this. What offers a better explanation for what we see, know, and experience? This is what we're going to talk about. What offers a better explanation for what we see, know, and experience? Is it the presence of a God, of a creator, or is it the absence of God and the absence of a creator? Which of those two sort of theories or suggestions or beliefs better explains what we know and understand and have experienced? Does the existence of God make more or less sense of what we know, right? Tim Keller, again, has a great analogy that I think helps us to understand this distinction in questions, okay? Now, it's a weird analogy, but go with me. He says, imagine there's a firing squad. There's somebody that's been decided that they need to be executed, and there's a firing squad. There's 10 marksmen that get brought out, and they're asked to stand 10 feet away from somebody who is to be killed. And they count to 10, and on 10, they shoot. And all 10 miss. All 10 of them miss. Okay? Now, you have been placed in charge of trying to figure out why all 10 of them missed. And none of these guys are talking. None of them are going to tell you anything. You have to decide, why did all 10 of these people miss? So just quickly, what are potential explanations for why all 10 of these guys missed? Yeah.
They chose to miss.
Option one is there's a conspiracy. What's option two?
They just did bad.
Okay, so here we have two possible explanations for what we see. 10 marksmen, the best marksmen, professional marksmen from 10 feet away, all missed. Explanation one is that, man, bad day. All 10 accidentally miss. Some guns messed up. Some of them just misaimed from 10 feet away. They missed. Option two is that something fishy must be going on here for 10 guys to all miss. Right? Now, the reason this example is good is because neither of these explanations can fully be proven. So the question we're left with is, which of the two is more plausible? Which of the two does a better job of explaining what we just witnessed, that 10 professional marksmen missed? Right? The odds of all 10 of them accidentally missing all at once is basically zero. So the only possible, reasonable, plausible explanation is that something fishy happened. And we can't prove it, but it's the most reasonable explanation for what we've witnessed, right? Is that for some reason these 10 people decided on this day that they were all going to miss on purpose. And that's sort of what we're getting at. That's the question we're asking with tonight, is what is more plausible? We can't prove that God exists by science. We can't prove that God does not exist by science. And both sides have the burden of proof placed on them. They have to do it. And so the question that we are left with is, what is more plausible? Every person in the world has faith. The question is, where will you place it? So this week and next week, I want to ask the question, is there a God? Not the Christian God. We're not getting there quite yet. Is there a God? Tonight, we're going to ask through the lens of science. Next week, we're going to ask through the lens of philosophy and reason and logic. And then the third week, we'll come back and say, okay, if there is a God, what makes us believe that it's the Christian God? And I would argue that history, proves that the Christian belief is reasonable. Okay? So tonight, does that sound good? Okay. Tonight I want to start with a story of this guy. His name is Anthony Flew. Has anybody heard of Anthony Flew before? Oh, nice. Westside Christian, shout out. Okay. Anthony Flew died in 2010 at the age of 87. He was British. And the BBC says, yeah, I don't know, he was British. So take it or leave it. You can think more or less of him, up to you. Okay. BBC says that in his heyday, he was widely seen as his country's leading atheist. He was basically Richard Dawkins of his day. He was publicly outspoken as an atheist, denying the existence of God, probably sort of poking fun at people who believed in God as if it were childish. He probably believed that theism, the belief in God, would die with as modernity advanced, as we learned more, and as science advanced, surely belief in God would fade out. And then in 2004, he changed his mind. 2004, he said, you know what, I actually believe in God. I believe that there was a creator. It just makes sense, right? So what happened? How did this brilliant philosopher get there? Well, the interesting thing is he looked at science. It wasn't some crazy, supernatural, wild faith experience. Not to poke fun at those. I've had one myself. But what happened is the more he learned, the more the world discovered, God didn't get less plausible to him. He actually became more plausible to him. This is what the BBC said. He explained that he, like Socrates, had simply followed the evidence. I hope I get to a place in life, by the way, where I get to compare myself to Socrates, right? Me, like Socrates, okay? But he followed the evidence. And the new evidence from science and natural theology made it possible to rationally advance belief in an intelligent being who ordered the universe. Anthony Flew, the leading atheist of his day, said, I simply followed the evidence. He had every incentive in the world to deny God's existence. He had developed a reputation as the leading atheist of his day. You know who's not a popular guy? The leading atheist who decides that God is real. Because the Christians probably don't like this guy to begin with, and now the atheists definitely don't like him. And yet, he decided, I followed the evidence and God was real. And he's not alone. Here's another brilliant guy named John Lennox, who's the professor of mathematics at Oxford. He says this, the more we get to know about our universe, the more the hypothesis that there is a creator God who destined the universe for a purpose gains in credibility as the best explanation of why we are here. Okay? It's amazing. So the question that I ask when I hear this is, what did these guys discover? What did they find in the world of science that led them to the place to say things like that? Tonight I want to talk about the two most compelling scientific questions that I think point us in the direction of a creator God. And again, I want to emphasize, probably overemphasize tonight, none of this is definitive proof. You are not going to be able to present this to someone and say, airtight, closed case, God exists. But what we have to ask is, do these things make it more reasonable to believe in God than not to believe in God? I, like Anthony Flew, believe that these show the existence of God to be the most reasonable explanation. So two things we're going to talk about. The origin of the universe and the miracle of life. All right, so let's start with the first question. Where did we come from? Where did we come from? Today, in 2019, what is the leading answer to this question in the world? Who can tell me? Yeah.
Big Bang.
Big Bang. Perfect. The Big Bang. Now, what's fascinating is I actually thought the exact same thing. But as I researched the Big Bang this week, the Big Bang actually doesn't claim to answer this question. Here's what the Big Bang theory is summarized. Big Bang is an attempt to explain how the universe developed from a very tiny, dense state into what it is today. Now, let me say one thing. As a Christian, you are allowed to believe in the Big Bang, okay? There is nothing the Big Bang professes that conflicts with or denies Orthodox Christianity, okay? I want to put that out there. But the problem with the Big Bang is it doesn't answer the most important question. Where did the tiny, dense state come from? The Big Bang tells us how we got from tiny, dense state to today, but it doesn't tell us where tiny, dense state came from. Now, we are obsessed with origin stories in 2019, right? Like superheroes, we need to know where they came from. Okay, the Big Bang is the equivalent of Spider-Man saying, well, one day he woke up and he was Spider-Man. We're not really sure what happened, but one day he woke up and he had webs coming out of his hand. Okay? It's not satisfying. We're like, no, we need to find out when the spider bit him and how this, where the spider came from, right? The Big Bang is not satisfying. Because it says we came from a small, tiny, dense state, but we don't know where that came from, right? The real question of origin comes back to this. At some point, we went from nothing to something. At some point, we went from nothing to a small, tiny, dense state that then, bang. Okay? How did we go from nothing to something? Do you know what science says? It's impossible. It's impossible for something to be created out of nothing. It has never happened before in history, science says. In fact, it violates the first law of thermodynamics, I've been told this week. Okay? The first law of thermodynamics says that energy and matter cannot be created or destroyed. And yet somehow we went from nothing to something. If matter cannot be created or destroyed, then how did we get here? There's two options. Option one is someone or something outside of time and space initiated and created small, tiny, dense matter that went bang. That's option one. Option two is that there is no God, so it's a closed system. There is nothing outside of the natural world, which means we came from nothing to something, and we're not really sure how. Maybe matter has existed forever. Maybe matter just is eternal, but then you've got all sorts of other questions about if matter is eternal, what that means, right? These are our options. Option one is essentially the God option, and option two is there is no God. And option two, I would say, has more questions. Okay, if there is no God, then how did it get there? Why is it there? If it's eternal, what does that mean? There's so many questions, right? So the question we have to ask ourselves is which is more reasonable? Which requires more faith? Again, neither of these can be proven, but the question is which is more compelling? Okay? And we could even add to this the greatness of our universe. Okay? Our universe is ridiculous. Did you know that our universe is 93 billion light years across? That means if you travel at the speed of light, which in case you are wondering is 9 million feet per second, it would take you 93 billion years to get from one end of our universe to the other. One light year is 6 trillion miles. Our universe has 93 billion of those. So if you do 93 billion times 6 trillion, that's how big our universe is, okay? Times miles, right? Not even like feet. We could do this crazier if we wanted to. Now, of course, it's possible that's an accident. It's possible. But what's more likely and what's more reasonable? You tell me. Okay, now the second argument, to me, the second half of this is even more compelling than the first. Okay, and it's what's called the fine-tuning theory. Has anybody ever heard of the fine-tuning theory? Okay, the fine-tuning theory goes like this. Science has long asked whether or not life exists elsewhere in our universe. And they've asked, in order for life to exist elsewhere, what is required? Like, what are the requirements for humans to be able to survive on a planet? And is there another planet out there somewhere in the 93 billion light years in which this is possible? Now, what we found is that as humans, we're pretty high maintenance, okay? We need a lot of things to go exactly right in order for us to be able to live. And the name of this comes from these dials. Like, if you imagine these dials, all of the dials for characteristics required for human life have to be turned exactly right. And if they get messed up even a little bit, then life can't exist. Okay? So 50 years ago, this guy Carl Sagan suggested, I think there are two criteria required for human life. Two criteria. The first is a certain kind of star, and the second is a certain kind of planet that is a certain distance from that star. So we've got a star and a planet that is a certain distance. Those are the only two requirements for life, Carl Sagan said 50 years ago. And he said, if those are the only two characteristics, then I would imagine that one out of every 1,000 stars would then have a planet capable of life. He said one out of every 1,000 stars would have a planet near it that was capable of human life. Now, in the last 50 years, do you know how many planets and stars we've found capable of human life? Zero. And it makes sense, because his number of two criteria, as of 2001, which is a long time ago, had grown to 150 criteria, okay? 150. So examples. We're talking how far do you have to be from, how far does the planet have to be from the star, in our case the sun? How fast is the planet moving? What percent is the of water is there on the planet? What is the atmospheric makeup? What is the ocean salt level? The carbon levels have to be exact. The mineral density has to be exact, etc. And if any one of these 150 dials is even slightly off, depending on the one, it's like, you know, in some it might be a percent, others it might be like a millionth of a percent off, then no human life. If any one of the 150. So let me give you a few examples. Okay, so one example, one characteristic required is the size of our planet, the mass of our planet. If our Earth was slightly bigger or slightly smaller, there would be no life capable of being of surviving here on Earth. Why is that? The answer is because if Earth were bigger, then gravity would be stronger. And if gravity were stronger, then gases like methane and ammonia, which have molecular weights of 16 and 17, in case you are wondering, they would remain closer to the Earth because gravity would pull them in. And you know what's really bad for humans? Methane and ammonia, okay? So if we were bigger and gravity were stronger, life would not be possible on planet Earth. But what happens if we're smaller? Well, then gravity would be weaker. As a result, water vapor, which has a molecular weight of 18, would not stay close enough, and water's sort of important for us. Okay, so if Earth were just slightly bigger or slightly smaller, gravity is slightly stronger or slightly weaker, no life on planet Earth. Okay, another example, how fast the Earth rotates. Roughly, the Earth rotates about 1,000 miles an hour. Okay? Now, if you're at the equator, it's faster, but we don't need to get in particulars. Okay? But 1,000 miles an hour is a nice round number. This is what popular science says. The Earth spinning too fast should not be high on your list of things to worry about, simply because it is not likely to happen soon, and if it does, you'll probably be too dead to worry about it. Popular science said this, okay? The idea is, if the Earth rotated too slowly, the temperature swings between day and night would be super extreme. They would be too dramatic. There would be sort of extreme weather, hurricanes, earthquakes, that kind of thing, okay? And if the Earth moved too fast, well, water levels would rise at the equator, and surface winds would grow. Did you know Jupiter has surface winds of 1,000 miles an hour, surface winds? You know where it'd be bad to live? 1,000 miles an hour of surface winds, okay? That's a second one. Speaking of Jupiter, Jupiter's our third example here, okay? Here's Jupiter in case you haven't seen it before. Another thing that we need in order for life to exist is a massive planet nearby. Why would we need a massive planet nearby? Astrologers say that if not for Jupiter, comets and debris strikes on Earth would be 1,000 times more frequent. Because Jupiter, which is 122 times larger than planet Earth and has gravity 318 times stronger than planet Earth, basically sucks every comet and every piece of debris that comes into our solar system straight into itself. And all of it gets just sucked into the middle of Jupiter. So nothing hits Earth. Okay? It's amazing. These are three examples of 150. Okay, but here's my favorite. We haven't even gotten to my favorite one. It's our moon. This is so crazy to me. Okay, the moon. If it were a different size or a different distance, then our tilt would be different. And if our tilt was different, guess what would happen? No life on planet Earth. Okay? You're picking up on this. Right? Without there be unstable temperatures, no seasons, etc. But here's the most fascinating part to me, which is the moon's creation. Okay? This is a book called Miracles by Eric Metaxas. It's super fascinating. I want to read you. It's a decently long chunk, but stay with me. Okay, this is about the moon. I think it's fascinating. Here's what science tells us, he writes. 4.25 billion years ago, Earth was much smaller than it is now and was still in a molten state. It wasn't even really the Earth yet, so let's call it Earth. Then, out of the infinite reaches of black space, traveling silently on a fixed trajectory for millions and millions and millions and millions of years and light years, a planetary body larger than Mars homed in on Earth and hit it directly. This unfathomably perfect collision of two bodies in the incalculable vastness of outer space made life, and therefore you and me, possible. The roughly Mars-sized mass that hit Earth was for the most part absorbed into Earth, so that Earth went from being Earth to actually being Earth. This is going to sound so weird on the recording to them, right? Our size was, via this collision, dramatically increased to what it is today, to the size we have already said is vital to the existence of life. But the remaining chunks produced by this cataclysmic collision began orbiting Earth and eventually coalesced to form what we now know as the moon. But another thing happened as a result of this collision, without which life could not exist. The head-on collision between these two objects was so perfectly aligned and therefore so cataclysmic that it blasted most of Earth's previous atmosphere into outer space, leaving us with the atmosphere we now have. The previous atmosphere on Earth was 40 times as thick as our current atmosphere, so sunlight could not reach the surface. If this collision had not happened precisely as it happened, we would not exist. Our atmosphere and our size were absolutely incapable of supporting life before, but perfectly capable of supporting life after. The addition of the extra mass to our planet also increased our iron content dramatically, allowing marine algae to flourish, which in turn allowed other marine life to flourish, which in turn allowed life on land to flourish. To say we wouldn't be here without this collision happening precisely as it did is an impossibly large understatement. But perhaps what is hardest to understand, as if that wasn't already hard to understand, is that the current state of Earth is the result of a seemingly random collision 4.25 billion years ago. It is no exaggeration to say that in the infinitude of space, for two bodies to collide as they did is like two bullets being shot from guns on either side of the Grand Canyon and meeting so perfectly head-to-head in midair that they canceled out each other's momentum and dropped vertically together into the canyon below. For such a thing to occur is essentially an impossibility, and yet somehow science tells us this happened. It can hardly be understood sufficiently, but if this collision had been ever so slightly less than head-on, or if these hurtling giants had missed each other by a hairbreadth, we wouldn't be here. Who could deny that to believe this collision happened randomly and by accident takes more faith than believing it was somehow directed to happen? This is not to say the collision didn't happen randomly and accidentally, only that believing it that it did so is extremely implausible, that the alternative must at least be considered. The human mind longs for meaning and for answers to such extraordinary mysteries. Just how might something so outrageously precise have simply happened? But if that astonishingly perfect collision hadn't happened precisely as it did, and if the size of Earth or the size of the Moon were slightly different, or if the rotation of Earth were slightly faster or slightly slower, or if Jupiter weren't as big as it is and positioned exactly where it is, life here couldn't even be dimly possible, much less a reality. And these are just a small handful of the parameters necessary for life to be possible. Okay, there are 150 of these things. 150, and they need to be perfect in order for life to exist. These aren't, hey, as long as we're close or as long as we get most of them right, perfect. Okay, now to put it numerically, I'm a math guy. If you're not a numbers person or a math person, you can tune out for like 30 seconds. But this is fascinating. As the number of dials increased, odds of finding a planet and a star was no longer 1 in 1,000, as you might imagine. Okay, here's the number. The odds of a planet being capable of sustaining human life is 1 over 10 to the 73rd power, which means 10 with 73 zeros after it. Okay? Now, there's a lot of planets and a lot of stars in our universe, right? There's about 10 to the 23 number of planets. Right? So it's not a small number. Which means if you wanted to know the odds of a single star-planet combination being capable of sustaining human life, you would do this equation. You would put 10 over 23, which is the number of planets, and you would divide it by 10 over 73, which is the odds of a single planet existing. Do you know what the answer is? The odds that a single planet would exist in our universe. 1 in 10 to the 50th power. Or to put this visually, that number. 1 in that number. Here's what Eric Metaxas concludes. He says, the odds against a planet supporting life have grown to unfathomable and dizzying heights of impossibility. As of now, 15 years into the 21st century, we know of so many conditions that are absolutely necessary for a planet to support life, that not only is it extremely improbable that any other planets can support life, it's extremely improbable that our planet should be able to support life. It's not an argument that it's improbable there's another planet out there. It's an argument that it's absolutely insane that even our planet exists in the universe. Which brings us back. What option offers the best explanation? What is the most likely explanation? What is the most reasonable explanation? Is it that there is an intelligent, supernatural creator out there, or that there isn't? One of my favorite quotes as I was researching the fine-tuning theory was from a scientist who is talking about the response to the fine-tuning theory. So atheists, in order to sort of argue against this, have suggested what is called the multiverse theory. How many people have heard of the multiverse theory? Okay, a number of you. The idea is that, well, maybe there's an infinite number of different universes out there. And so 1 out of 10 to the 50 is like, well, if there's 5 times more than that universes, whatever. Okay. Now, there's a guy from MIT named Alan Lightman, And he basically says, if you want to know how strong the fine-tuning theory is, look at the ridiculousness of what is proposed against it. He says it is so strong that scientists have created a theory without a shred of evidence or any way to test it. Okay? He calls it science's crisis of faith. One guy goes even further. This is philosopher Richard Swinburne, who's also from Oxford. He says, to postulate a trillion other universes rather than one God in order to explain the orderliness of our universe seems the height of irrationality. But this is where we are. What is more reasonable? Knowing what we know about our universe, knowing what we know about our planet, knowing what we know about our history, what is the most reasonable, logical, plausible explanation? When I was growing up, I was sort of taught subconsciously that to believe in God was not reasonable. That to believe in God required turning off of my brain, like I needed to go to church and stop thinking for a little bit, and then I could come out and keep thinking. Don't look too hard into science, don't talk too much, and you'll be okay. This is the secular culture that we live in, that I grew up in, right? I was taught that belief in God was wishful thinking, and that this type of wishful thinking would die the more I was educated. The more our world learned, the more science grew, the more that religion would die. But it's not true. It's an absolute lie. This is what Tim Keller's book says. Most sociologists of religion now agree that the idea that religion declines as a society becomes more modern has been shown to be empirically false. Countries such as China are becoming more religious and Christian even as they modernize. The idea that we are going to learn enough to where Christianity becomes obsolete is actually being proven to be the opposite of true. The more we learn, the more people become Christian. The more we modernize, the more people become Christian, right? In fact, some of the brightest minds in science are believers. In history, you have people like Galileo, Sir Isaac Newton, Sir Francis Bacon, all Christians. Today, the same is true. Has anyone heard of Francis Collins before? Francis Collins is the head of the Human Genome Project. He helped complete groundbreaking research into human DNA and gene sequencing, and he's a Christian. Lisa Meitner, she was born Jewish. She was part of a team that discovered nuclear fission. She's a Jesus follower, right? The reality is that some of the brightest minds have done the same thing that Anthony Flew did 20 years ago. They didn't follow the culture, they followed the evidence. They didn't turn off their brains, they turned on their brains, and they thought, and they asked questions. And at the end of that pathway, at the end of that trail, was not atheism, but belief in God. So my challenge to you is don't turn off your brains, but study more. Ask bigger questions. Think harder. There is no question that you will ever ask that is too big for the God of the universe if he's real. And again, nothing I've said tonight is proof, airtight proof that God exists. But what it is it's a reminder that to believe in God is reasonable. God is a God of order. He's a God of truth. He's not a God that's going to force us to believe things that don't make sense. And the good news is we don't have to. Because the more we learn about astronomy, the more we learn about science, the more we learn about our bodies, the more unbelievable it is to believe that God is not real. Right? And so the question we have to ask again, I've said it so many times, is what makes more sense? What is more reasonable? What is more plausible? Better answers? Which offers better answers to how we got here? Which offers better answers to the improbability of life? To me, in my life, the answer is clearly God. Clearly. And this is just a small piece of the equation. This isn't even all we had to work on. I think if this is all we had, we'd be in okay shape. But as we're going to talk about next week, we're like scratching the surface, right? Francis Collins could probably tell you things about science that I don't even know how to spell about why he believes in God, right? But we have enough. We have enough to believe. This is just a small piece. So my challenge to you is to turn on your brains, to keep thinking, to keep asking questions, and hopefully come back next week, and we'll talk more about philosophically. How do we get to the idea of human rights? How do we get to the idea that there's a purpose? Why do we all walk around with a sense that there's more out there? Could it be that the most reasonable explanation for that is because we were created?